Our next speaker is Dr. Wallace Sharif. He received his PhD here at Vanderbilt in 2003 in biochemistry. He then did postdoctoral training at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Currently, he's an assistant professor of biology at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, where he studies the role of telomerase in response to severe cellular hypoxia and in using telomere length as a diagnostic measure of health status in African Americans. Please join me in welcoming Wallace Sharif.
So it's great to be here back at Vanderbilt. This campus has experienced a remarkable transformation since I left about 8 years ago, and it's incredible to be back here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my experiences at Morehouse College. I've been there, I just wrapped up my third year there. Talk a little bit about what it's like to go from this kind of heavy scientific environment to teaching and trying to incorporate research into my work. And so I work at Morehouse College. Morehouse College is an all-male, historically black college and institution, founded in 1867. And as of now, we have about 2,600 students there, so it's relatively small. And the way the college is organized, it's roughly split between three divisions, the Division of Humanities, which includes English and political science, sociology, the Business Administration, and then Science and Mathematics. And obviously, I'm in the Science and Mathematics. And Morehouse is a liberal arts institution, so there's a heavy focus on the teaching aspect and a broad-based liberal arts education. I graduated from Morehouse College. Of course, I have a deep appreciation for the school, and I'll say that I don't think there's any place like it in the country. The campus is about 90% African-American male. The remaining maybe 7% are black, foreign national males, and then maybe 3% Asian and white. And so we have this population that is historically underserved, struggles in higher education for lots of reasons. They're some of the first to leave college when finances get difficult or that they have to support their families and things of that nature. So I think it's a beautiful thing that we focus on that particular population. And I have to say, I don't know if you can read this, but we don't, you know, baby our students. And this was a short little piece that came out in Huffington Post last spring that put Morehouse in one of the top eight most grueling schools in the country. And I don't remember all of the other ones, but it included Swarthmore and MIT. And in particular, they pointed out our pre-medical and pre-dentistry checks, which are basically based out of biology. So my department. And so we definitely have a kind of infamous reputation on the campus and outside as far as putting our students through through the paces. Of course, you know, we would argue that those that successfully make it through our program would be great physicians, doctors, or scientists. So I'm going to talk briefly about what led me back to Morehouse. And as I started at Vanderbilt, this is kind of where, you know, I thought that my career would go. And I thought that I would finish graduate school in 4 years, of course, with several high-quality publications. I'd be so good that I could skip a postdoc and go right into industry. And then after, you know, making lots of money in industry, I would retire at a small liberal arts institution like Morehouse. And I always, actually in my application to Vanderbilt, I said that I wanted to go back to a place like Morehouse eventually. So it's really amazing that I was able to do that. But nothing in my career path came out as planned. And since you guys are at least in graduate school, I won't talk about kind of what motivated my decisions in graduate school and choosing lab. I will say that, you know, I had an interesting graduate experience. My advisor here at Vanderbilt, he was a new advisor. He took about 5 years while I was with him to get R01, and then as soon as he got that, he was denied tenure, so spent another year and a half looking for a job. I saw all of that as I was going through, and got relatively quickly burned out on science and research. In fact, it wasn't until he transferred over to University of Arkansas for medical sciences in Little Rock, and I went with them for about a year and a half. Of course, I dreaded that transition, but it was really good for me. I went from, I think, in his eyes and in my eyes, being a student to really being a independent functioning scientist. And so as much as I hated initially that transition, it worked out very well. It motivated me to continue into the sciences. So as I was wrapping up in graduate school, you know, I think most of these things you guys will actually be exposed to here. I thought about leaving the bench, at least for a little while. I was seriously interested in, you know, maybe doing something like medical liaison work or science policy, which I guess they'll talk about later. I'm actually still interested in science policy or science education policy, so I'm thinking when I have some time for a sabbatical, that might be something that I'll end up doing. And I'm also interested in primary education, high school education, and motivating scientists in that level. But I did what, you know, most people do, which is a postdoc. And it's good. Morehouse, it turns out, you know, won't take you if you haven't had a postdoc in the sciences, at least. So for me, it's pretty much a necessary, even if you're focusing on your teaching aspect, they want you to have that type of postdoctoral training and independent science training, and to bring that into the classroom. So, you know, when I was looking for a postdoc, I basically wanted the opposite experience of what I had in graduate school. You know, I was in a very small lab. We had struggled with funding and things of that nature. So for me, I wanted to choose the biggest, you know, most famous lab I possibly could. I was fairly sure I wanted to be in the South, so I was looking in that area. And I think one of the things that I didn't realize until after I got to Southwestern was the influence of the personality of the lab. And, you know, I went from a very small lab, which at one point consisted of me and my PI, to one that had something on the order of 27 people split among two groups. So I went to laboratory of Jerry Shea and Woody Wright. This was maybe a couple of years after I started, so I'm up there on the left there. I'll say one of the things as I was thinking postdoc, I did, I studied homologous recombination and chromosome segregation in yeast, and I knew that I could have continued on in that path, but I started to think about what I really wanted to do, and this is a beautiful thing about choosing a postdoc, is you can decide to change and do whatever it is that you want to do. And I was biochemistry here at Vanderbilt. We had these journal clubs, semester-long or year-long journal club type class. And I remembered when I did that journal club class, I really kind of focused on what was then some relatively new discoveries in the molecular mechanisms of aging. And to me, that was fascinating. I mean, this was some science fiction stuff that, you know, this process of aging could be distilled down to a couple of molecular pathways in which interventions can be created for those pathways, and you can have dramatic effects on the age of a organism. So these are actually a couple of figures from David Sinclair, who's now at Harvard, who works with resveratrol. And what he saw, you know, or what he shows there is basically that you can make a change to one protein and double the lifespan. I think on the left there is yeast, and on the right is worms, nematodes. So, you know, to me that was fascinating. And as I was finishing up my graduate work, I actually stayed with my graduate advisor for about 6 months to think about what I wanted to do. And I said, this is neat, you know, this is something that I want to explore, so let me go and see if I can. So it turns out that Jerry and Woody were looking for people who were good in homologous recombination, so I managed to work my way into a job there. And I ended up doing telomere research for a few years. As a postdoc, telomeres are the ends of the chromosomes that act as a molecular stopwatch, if you will, and set the maximum lifespan of a series. So, you know, I had a great experience at my postdoc, and, you know, my graduate advisor and my postdoc advisor would tell me that you know, the postdoc was going to be the best time of your life. I didn't believe them at the time, but in retrospect, it is. But, you know, the postdoc had to end, and, you know, it ends when you get a job, and it's however you can con, you know, blackmail, cajole your way into one. You know, if you can convince somebody to give you a paycheck, then you... you leave your postdoc. And I actually, you know, I think I did a postdoc for 3 years, and I agree. I think I could have used another year in that postdoc. But I actually went to Morehouse to party for homecoming and ended up making the rounds talking to teachers. And literally the conversation was, you know, what are you up to now? I said, well, I'm at UT Southwestern, and the dean of the division of science and mathematics says, wow, that's a famous place. You know, they have a lot of Nobel laureates there. And he said, well, who are you working with? And I said, well, Jerry Shea and Woody Wright. He said, whoa, those are famous people, you know? They're going to be up for the Nobel Prize. I said, well, no. But, you know, they're working in a field that's hot. So he said there was a job opening and said, I should submit an application. And so literally, you know, I submitted, you know, one application and interviewed there. I didn't have a lick of teaching experience, actually, and somehow managed to convince somebody to write me a paycheck. And I'll say, if Vanderbilt, you know, if the students are anything like they were when I was here, many of us came from a similar type of background, a small liberal arts institution. So it's very important to maintain those connections, either for going back if you liked your undergraduate work, or for getting, you know, into that network of job openings and things of that nature. So, you know, this is just briefly the mission statement for the Morehouse College Biology Department. I won't go through all of this, but of course there's a heavy emphasis on analytical skills, scientific reasoning, and really bringing the process of science into, you know, this kind of massive amount of information that we throw at the students. And even at a place like Morehouse, which is definitely a liberal arts institution, there's a heavy emphasis on continuing and maintaining an active research program. Now, the emphasis is on educating students. So I think the focus of your research is a little bit different than it would be at a place like Morehouse, but you are expected to maintain active research. And, you know, even if you go in wanting to teach, that research is going to be an important component of both your promotion and your success at the institution. So I'll make a couple of notes of my experience over these last 3 years about teaching at a liberal arts institution and the differences from coming out of a postdoc. And I'll say, you know, the postdoc was really, in a literal sense of a word, an ivory tower. By the time you're hitting a postdoc or even an upper-level graduate program, you are surrounded by really smart, highly motivated people who are ambitious and generally hardworking. And the real world isn't like that, and an undergraduate college environment isn't like that. And it really smacks you in the face a lot of times. You know, people have different motivations, and you're struck with that. And everybody, I think, as a first-year professor, comes up with these exams that, you know, are graduate-level exams, and you expect your freshmen to rise to that occasion, and it just doesn't happen. So you have to temper your expectations a little bit. At a place like Morehouse, again, all-male institution, the student interaction really matters, and what that means is that you have to invest a lot of time in mentorship. And so my expectation coming into college, into the professoriate, was that I would teach biology, you know, I would have a lab, and I would talk about biology all the time. So I was really shocked my first year when I had an hour and a half conversation about somebody's parents or girlfriend or whatever else is going on in the student's life. And so that's something that you have to expect, and the mentorship and the way in which you present yourself is very important, at least in a place like Morehouse. You know, as a consequence of that, you see something that I seldom saw in the sciences, which is kind of immediate gratification. I mean, you can see changes in students in the matter of weeks. You can see in a classroom as they kind of light up and they get this concept because you used a great analogy or something like that. So it's quite different from kind of toiling away for 6 months on a project to have it fail and then finally, you know, get it going again. And there is a different skill set that's needed from straight bench work. You have to be engaging. You have to be diplomatic. Some of those things you don't have to do in a laboratory setting. You can isolate yourself sometimes in a laboratory, and you can't do that in a collegiate environment. And time management is a critical skill to learn. And as a postdoc and graduate students, your time, you know, is very cheap, right? You can work till midnight if you need to. At least that's what your PIs expect you to do. But it's not the case in college. You have, and I'll show you a list of kind of a week for me, but you have all of these commitments and you have all of these things pulling at you, and you have to figure out and prioritize which one you're going to do and how you can do this in a way that satisfies your career goals, benefits the students, and benefits your own personal life. So I use a process called getting things done. When I'm disciplined, I use that. A very nice kind of time organization thing, but whatever you do to manage it, it's necessary. So I'll say a couple of words about compensation. You know, Morehouse is a liberal arts institution, and we tend to attract a lot of what we call faculty alumni, people who have gone to Morehouse and come back. I think they take advantage of that because their salary is not that great. So at Morehouse in the Division of Math and Sciences, the range is from 50 to 60,000 as a base salary range. That it tends to be that the psychologists and the mathematicians are at the lower end of that, and the biologists and the chemists are at the higher end of that. It turns out, considering that you've had, you know, 8 to 10 years of post-baccalaureate experience, that's a shockingly low number. But it turns out that, at least in the South, that's actually relatively high. The average, at least when I was looking at positions for assistant professors, and was around $48,000. So this 50 to 60 is entry level at Morehouse, but I think, you know, the English professors kind of are on the low end of that. Now, what I didn't realize as I came in there is that this was a 9-month contract. So the expectation is that you're free for 2 of the 3 months out of the summer. That actually makes a significant difference. So if you get a grant, you get 2 months salary. And that 2 month salary is not based on your monthly paycheck, but it's based on the 9 months. And so, you know, a grant from NSF will net you, you know, if you're at the 60,000 range, it'll net you an additional $15,000 or something to that effect. NIH is similar. And then, you know, another thing I didn't realize at all is that you can do a lot of independent consulting at Morehouse. And I was a molecular biologist. I didn't think anybody would want me to consult on anything, but because we're, you know, a dime a dozen. But it turns out that there are lots of programs on campus. They need academic advisors and their research programs. So over summer, you could teach summer school. So there are ways to get, without a lot of work, additional income on the order of $10,000 to $12,000. So, you know, you can begin to push up your salary, and is something that I think is respectable for PhDs. At Morehouse, just a little talk of the tenure process. Mind you, I haven't gone through it, so I don't know exactly how. I don't have the intimate details, but what they rate us on are three fields: teaching, service, and scholarship. And at Morehouse, the minimum expectations are that you meet expectations in two areas and exceed expectations in one area. So for service, we're talking about serving on basically collegiate committees, professional societies, things of that nature. And I'll say, you know, even though they will pretend that it's equally weighted, I'll say that service is probably least beneficial in terms of your tenure process. For teaching, you're judged by your peers and also by your students, but I think in general they really look for you to develop new teaching tools, and so you want to do something different than kind of a didactic lecture, and you really want to drive the nature of teaching in the school. And since Morehouse is a teaching institution, that's very important. But, you know, scholarship is the big one, and so at Morehouse we expect you to publish, I think the expectation is 3 papers with Morehouse students as authors in 6 years plus a funded grant. And that pretty much guarantees your tenure. Not a lot of people have hit that mark, and so then it becomes they look at the total package type thing. But if you do that, you're in. So that's my goal, at least. And I'll just kind of wrap up with this. You know, this is a typical kind of week in my life here, and it doesn't matter what these are. I'll just say that each of those blocks represent some fixed meeting or pressure pull on my time. And that goes from something like 8 to 7 or so in the evening. So somewhere in there, I have to find time to make lectures and really drive research. And, you know, you see I have a little bit of time on Wednesday mornings and Friday mornings and maybe Tuesday afternoons in this particular semester to do that. And so you have to come up with a full research plan in that amount of time and also motivate students to do work as well. So I'll wrap up with that. We talked a little bit about my research interests, but, you know, it's not germane. So, questions?
So I'll open the floor to a couple few questions. And speak loudly.
I am a cellular and molecular biologist, and so I teach general biology, and I think it was quite a shock to have to figure out the circulatory system or the diversity of life, so all of the organisms in life, and those are the type of things that I wasn't prepared for. So my first year, I think, designing my lectures took probably something on the order of 9 hours per lecture. And that I tell my students that they should study the way I prepare for a lecture, which is to look at multiple sources, you know, go on YouTube and see if I can find something and things of that nature.
I do miss teaching, and I tried to teach for as long as I could, but what you find is that things pop up when you're an administrator. So I tried teaching for a while, graduate course at the end of the day, and I never had quite enough time to get my complete lecture prepared. So 2 of the 3 hours would be great, and the last hour wasn't so great, and I felt like I was giving my students short shrift. Then I tried teaching early in the morning, and then things would happen early in the morning. The one thing that I've taught most recently that provides a great deal of makes you feel really good is teaching first-year experience. I haven't taught it in very recent years, but I think I will soon go back and teach the first year experience course again. Gives you an opportunity to meet new students. You're actually helping them engage in the university and have a, or the college, and have a successful first semester. And that doesn't take the kind of preparation that teaching biology would take.
Yeah. How much time do you have? So recruiting students is not an issue at all. There are lots of scholarship programs, and one of those requirements is that they work in a lab. So you have a plethora of students. You know, the issue that most of us have is doing research in a liberal arts institution. So, you know, we are very used, coming out of a postdoc, to being able to order some reagent, you know, at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday and get it in by Wednesday morning. The process at Morehouse is you order it. It takes maybe 2 weeks to get through the business office. Then it goes to purchasing, and purchasing literally mails the purchase order to the vendor. And then you get it. So, you know, you're talking about, upwards of a month turnaround time. So that isn't the way science is done, and the school is not, you know, driven by science, so it's not something that we can effectively change.
And I can speak to that, too. It's been a long time since I've had my research lab, but as I said, St. John's is not a research university, and I think there are a couple of things you need to watch out for. I wanted that balance of teaching and research, but what you find is in some places like St. John's, the grad students are mostly local. So you're not recruiting nationally, really, the brightest and the best necessarily. And the other piece is that it was back then, and I think it might be harder now, to be accepted by the NIH, for example, as really doing relevant research and having them believe that you're going to be able to have the kind of research agenda they expect from you. When I was at St. John's, I was funded the entire time I was a faculty member, but I was actually funded through the American Heart Association. I actually was never successful in getting NIH funding when I was there. So something to consider when you're looking at research opportunities.
Can I have one more thing? There are, you know, I don't think there's any expectation of a lot of R01s coming through Morehouse College, but there are mechanisms. We use the SCORE mechanism, which is a kind of a parallel funding mechanism through the NIH, and there are other mechanisms for smaller schools.
I think we'll take one more question.
As I said, I did a 2.5-year postdoc, and my advisor was actually pretty upset I left after 2.5 years. I think if I had done a longer postdoc, I actually would have had a better track record, might have ended up at a research institution, but that being said, might not have been the right place for me, because I think I've found the right place for me. But I do think that it would have positioned me better for a job at a top-notch research institution.
Publications, period. But, you know, there's some maybe training and things like that, but it really just would have, I think, you know, I left some things for a graduate student who's still there, and I'm still waiting for that to happen. So.
Can I say one last thing about postdocs? One of the things that was really helpful to me, and when you're looking at postdoc advisors to consider, is I had spent a good part of my postdoc, this was a long time ago, don't forget, developing antibodies to one of the first fibroblast growth factors. And my postdoc advisor allowed me to take those antibodies with me when I left so that I was able to very quickly establish my own research lab because I had the reagents I needed to do that. So you want to look for a mentor who's willing to give you a piece of something that you can take with you when you go on.
All right, well, let's thank our speakers, and I'm sure they'll be around.